Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Yukari, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Tonight we take an insider's look at the mobile apps industry in the eyes of mobile app industry through the eyes of some who are breaking new ground with their new companies and ventures. We've assembled an exciting panel of technology leaders and experts. First, we've got Krishna Subramanian. He's the co-founder of MobClix, the industry's largest mobile ad exchange network, and he leads the product and marketing strategy for the company. Tim Chang is the principal at Norwest Venture Partners. He's a leader in social gaming and works with NVP's investment practice in China and the Asia Pacific. Shervin Peshawar is the founder and executive chairman of the Social Gaming Network, and the Financial Times named him Bill Gates' worst nightmare. And finally, we have Lisa Marino, the chief revenue officer of Rocku. She oversees all business functions and leads all brand and ad sales initiatives for the company. Please welcome our panel. So I just want to start by asking each of our panelists how you think apps have changed the way consumers play games, access content, and communicate with each other, and where you think the best opportunities are in the ad space right now.
Well, I suppose I'll jump in. And given my background on the gaming side of the house from a Rocku perspective, it's pretty evident that you're seeing both on the app side as well as a Facebook platform environment, the evolution of these environments similar to how the web has developed several years ago, right? You start initially with communication, then you move to entertainment, and then all of a sudden you've got content consumption and shopping sort of morphing in or playing a major role in these execution as well. I think in the case of Facebook and mobile, we're sort of in phases one and two of those executions where entertainment really is leading the pack at this stage of the game in terms of how people are spending their time in mobile and in Facebook environments. I know from our perspective, you know, we do a lot on the gaming side of the house, and you know, you've got providers out there who have 25, 30 million daily active users worldwide engaging their games and platforms, and so it's a huge source of consumption of content for a variety of players, both in mobile and on Facebook.
So I, Yukari and I were talking about this recently last week, and one of the comments that I made is that, you know, anyone that's doing games on platforms outside of these newer platforms, they're essentially the Walking Dead. and so, you know, if I was developing for, you know, Xbox or, you know, Flash-based gaming portal and so on, it's essentially that's looking into the past, and the future is about these types of devices like the iPad and iPhone and Android devices, you know, and it's not just games, it's how we consume information and mm-hmm. and entertainment, and if you're playing with the iPad and you're watching, you know, your shows on the ABC app, or you're watching movies on the Netflix app, or you're playing your games, multiplayer games over 3G that are basically Xbox quality graphics, mm-hmm. like the kind of games that we've launched at Social Gaming Network. It essentially replaces the functions of previous platforms. And so also we have this whole new generation of young people who are growing up with the iPhone and iPad. You know, I mean, my little, you know, 2-year-old nephew has already, you know, cracked the iPhone and knows how to use all of the functions. And, you know, they're never going to use computers the way we use them. And what I've said with the iPad is that essentially it's going to turn our laptops into our generation's rotary phones. It's going to replace those functions. And when that happens, and it's happening now, it's pretty much a revolution in how we actually structure and build our actual applications. And you look at things like, if anyone has the iPad, the Elements app. I don't know if you've seen that. It's called Elements. It's a book, but it's an app. So they didn't release it for the iBook, for the Yeah, I have a distribution channel. They launched it for the App Store, and essentially, when you go into it, it's a book about all the elements, and you go in, and all of the elements are moving in pictures. It looks like
the periodic table elements.
The periodic table,
okay.
Yeah. And so, so basically, you it looks like a Harry Potter newspaper with the moving pictures, and you can actually spin them and look around them, and there's video and 3D stereoptic view, and that just totally changes the way we think about books and knowledge and consumption of knowledge.
So I would agree with what Lisa and Shervin have pointed out. Just give you a bit of backdrop. So I've been focused on mobile since 99 when NTT Docomo launched the iMode. So this mobile app stuff has actually been around for more than 10 years. The biggest difference you were asking about, U.S. consumers care. So people have been trying this for years. Nokia had tried Download Manager, Nokia Ovi. Nobody kind of cared. And so finally we're getting consumer adoption. And a big, big shift is that mobile content, mobile apps used to be paid content or paid apps only. You tried to get people to pay to download something. And back in Europe, where a lot of mobile content first started, we used to call the 3Gs. It wasn't 3G as in 3G networks, but 3Gs, girls, games, gambling. That's what drove mobile content. And then it has shifted since then towards a whole range of apps once the iPhone really kicked the industry in the butt and got things moving. But even iPhone, when it first started, apps phase 1.0, try to sell that app for $2.99, $4.99, $9.99. Mm-hmm. But with the flood of applications, this gravity, this weight of all the noise in the market pulled the price points down to 99 cents, and then where it should go logically is free. And I think, companies like Shervin's and others are very smart. They recognize what happened in the gaming world, social games. How many of you played Farmville or games like that? I'm sure you've seen those on Facebook, right? They're free-to-play games with in-game transactions, a model originally invented by the Asians. And then Facebook game makers figured out how to adopt that from the U.S., and now that trend is happening on mobile apps now. Mm-hmm. So instead of trying to charge for it, go to free and then monetize with in-app transactions. And that's sort of the big opportunity. And then add advertising on top, and you get new revenue models.
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the biggest things that the iPhone brought is, a way to get bite-sized content that's movable. And the biggest difference between the iPhone and the iPad is the iPad is really it's a destination to consume different types of content. Now you're looking at Netflix, which is pretty much a subscription service, but that app has changed the way people interact with the iPad. Period. Right. I think it's probably one of the best apps that are out there in terms of live streaming movies. And I think we're getting to a stage where apps are going to be on every type of platform, not just on mobile, not just on phones or tablets. But Samsung's releasing a TV platform that'll have applications, and it's not going to be too far away from when your fridge is going to tell you you're out of milk and send a message to the app on your phone to remind you to buy milk when you're out at the store. And so I definitely think apps are going to be a central, native applications, I should say, are going to be a centralized part of life.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, given what you guys just said, how has that affected how you develop your games or the business models around it? A lot of things have changed about the app stores and the Apple App Store specifically. How is that? Where were you before a year ago, and where are
sure.
you now?
I mean, when we launched our first games on the App Store on the iPhone, right when the App Store opened, so it was within 60 days, and it was a game called iGolf. So it was basically I was watching my brother-in-law, and he has this nervous habit of practicing his golf swing with an invisible golf club. And, I thought, oh, I could put an iPhone in his hand and use the accelerometer, and you could have a golf game that could actually swing the iPhone. And it worked, and that took off. We had, 2 million users, free users, within about 60 days. And everything else, eyeball and all the other things that we've done were built on that success. But the problem, as Tim pointed out, was that Apple wasn't allowing microtransactions inside of free apps for about a year. We just kind of kept the faith that would happen, because that was the point. Like the way these models work, and we saw it on Facebook, was if you can scale to tens of millions of active users, and you can sell bite-sized pieces of content within those games, whether they're virtual goods, then you truly have a great model to scale with. So Apple finally allowed microtransactions in November of 2009, and we made a huge switch. And you know, to your question, we went from our premium apps that we're selling for an average of $3 to $4 each, games like Fast and Skies of Glory, and we switched them all to free apps so people could actually download them by Christmas of 09 for free. And what happened is we went from 600,000 paid users on Fast to over 3.5 million users on Fast. And we went from, you know, basically 3x the number of engaged users per month and 3x the actual average revenue per month. So we went from about 99 cents to $3 per month in micro. So we were selling missiles, bullets, you know, everything for the missile, for the jets that we, you could find. And that's essentially what's basically within 24 months at Rock U and other companies on social gaming on Facebook have, you know, basically scaled to a multi-billion dollar market. Well,
when you think of monetization inside of a game, and it could be an iPhone game, it could be another mobile application, it could be something on Facebook, you're really looking at monetizing a good game between 3 and 5% of your user base. And, you know, the majority of that's going to come from direct payments, meaning people who whip out their credit cards or use PayPal to buy some sort of virtual currency or premium item in a game. You'll get some, call it 15% of the revenue coming through what we call an offer wall environment, so users signing up for Netflix in a subscription-based model in exchange for virtual currency in a game that they can use to buy premium items. One of the things, though, that we look at very aggressively as a company at Rock U is how you get that monetization rate from, you know, 5% in the best case scenario up to 25%. And that's when your game really takes off from a revenue and impact and stickiness perspective. And that's when things like advertising comes into play and how brands, for example, sponsor different elements, different items, different experiences in a game that allow us as publishers to create richer experiences sponsored by the brand, but allow the users to level up in a game without having to pay for it, right? Because in today's environment, you've got the 95-5 rule. 95% of the people want to level up, but they don't want to pay for it. And you've got to give them something in there to release that pent-up demand in order to really release the liquidity and the vibrant nature within your game.
So how do you do that, Lisa? Can you give us an example?
So we've done it in a variety of different ways. We've got one ad unit called Deal of the Day, and it has a 30% CTR. So 30% of the people who see this, 30%
CTR
of the impressions.
Just
click-through rate.
So 30% of the people who are shown this button for free virtual currency inside of our games click on it, and they may get a Facebook credit for watching a video. They may get wildlife points for playing a Flash minigame. So of the 30% that actually click on the button, 40% of the people complete the offer. And in that environment, they're gaining virtual currency in a repeatable capacity where we as the publisher are winning because we're monetizing that user and call it 25, 30% of the user base. And that user over a series of days or weeks can now buy the cool limited edition panda bear in the game or whatever it is that we're offering that's a special, you know, limited time only item. So those are the types of things that we provide. And again, most of it's brand sponsored. And when you think of brands, it's Procter & Gamble, it's Axe, it's any of the major consumer goods or auto companies or movie releases that you might think of. Those are the people who are really participating in a pretty substantial way within social media. In particular, and I know iPhone apps and mobile apps are a little bit different here, but the really big social games are all mom demos. I don't care if you're talking Farmville, Zoo World, Social City. The demo in most of these games, or the people that pay, are 35 to 50-year-old women. They look just like me. And believe me, our games get me for about $10 a week. So that's the demo in these games, right? They're 70% women, and that's why it's so attractive to brands and advertisers who are trying to reach the mom demo, because they're spending 10, 15, 20 minutes a day in these games going back multiple times, where you really can capture their attention.
So I'll throw in a caveat. You've heard us talk about shifting to free-to-play with virtual goods and advertising, and it sounds great. It sounds like a cure-all, and it can be, but you can't bolt it on, because to your point of how you change your design of the games, mm-hmm. you have to bake it from the ground up for this.
Yes.
So you can't just take an old-school casual game like Tetris or whatever and say, oh, I'm going to bolt virtual goods into it and then stick ads on top. It doesn't quite work like that. So this is a real challenge for the game industry, especially old-school casual game designers who are used to basically coding and then shipping, and you're done and you move on. Mm-hmm. Instead, you got to design your game as a service, meaning it's mm-hmm. constantly running. It's like a perpetual service with a community you have to maintain. You have to add expanded content and expansion packs of items, and you actually have to have an operations team managing these things. Mm-hmm. The traditional three-person casual developer shop doesn't do that. You have to build a back end for this too. Mm-hmm. And so this is actually a good example for what apps are happening in general. It used to be apps was just a piece of code. You build it, you ship it, you're done. Now all apps, not just games, but even, you know, the Newsweek app or the Wall Street Journal app, they're becoming what I call apps as a service. So you have to maintain these things.
But amidst, amid all this, you know, calculation about monetization and everything, where does quality, where does creativity come into this?
Oh, it's vital, right? Because if you think about, I don't care what app you're talking about, there are three things that matter, and they matter in this order. One is launch power. Two is retention. Here's where creativity and stickiness and quality of the game or the application or whatever the user experiences, that's where it comes in. And then the third element is monetization. And the reason I say they're in that order is because you don't get an app to be big unless you've got substantial launch power. Launch power can come from buying users, so paid method. It could come from leveraging other apps that you have and cross-selling users into a new experience that you've just developed, or it can come from leveraging viral channels on the mobile platforms or Facebook or some of these other executions. But until you've got a critical mass of users in an app, the other two elements don't necessarily kick in.
I want to disagree with that a little bit. We promise that you and I, we always
yes,
debate
we always,
each other.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I think, you know, the opportunity for independent developers and smaller shops to come into these platforms and succeed, especially on places like iPhone, Android, are still, I think, available at scale. And I think CrowdStar was a good example of kind of mm-hmm. the last chance to come in and do it at scale without having full launch power, and it was done through, you know, really the creativity of the games.
Absolutely.
And you know, cracking the code on the virality of those games. So I agree with you that once you have those three things to play with, like Rock U has and Playdom has and Zynga has, then you can do things at the scale of, you know, 50 million plus active types of users. But the opportunity is still there. And I just want to kind of give maybe a little bit of a history lesson, I think, because I don't know if our audience listening or here knows the full story of how these games really started on Facebook and where it all came from. And I think, you know, if you look at it, F8 happened. The first F8 was the summer of 2007, where Facebook opened up. And that was a very pivotal moment for all of us in the industry. With, you know, the people that knew that was coming or was, you know, realized that that was a really big deal. Platforms opening up like that for free was not something that was normal. It wasn't something, it was pretty revolutionary. And I think, you know, we owe Mark Zuckerberg for having the courage to open up. If he wanted to, he could have used Facebook to create his own, typical of the companies like Microsoft, et cetera, in the past, to build his own channels for games and profit from that. But instead, he wanted to open up a ecosystem for developers to really thrive in, and it succeeded, I think, beyond his wildest dreams, and obviously to an extent with some of his family activities that they've had to, you know, continually, you know, modify and iterate it backwards. But what happened is, you know, we were at the first F8. We launched, a number of apps. One of them was a game called Warbook. Another one of our team members made a game on his own called Mob Wars. And Mob Wars became a hit.
Yep.
And it was the first game to really hit $1 million a month in revenue.
Yep.
And this was the guy I discovered when he was 17 years old in Maryland at a company called Webs.com. So I recruited him through Craigslist into the company as an engineer, sent him to Korea, taught him all about virality, et cetera, and all of that investment paid off handsomely for him. And he basically grew that game. I think the peak was at the time, like, it's funny now that we say it, it sounds really small, but it was, I think, 3 or 4 million mm-hmm. uniques a month. But he was making $1 million a month,
yeah.
and he was 21 years old. So what do you do in that situation, right? It's a little insane. But he didn't have the capacity to build a real company around that. And what happened was people like Mark Pincus at Zynga saw that game and said, oh, wow, this is interesting, because they were doing poker and so on, and basically cloned it in a game called Mafia Wars.
same art.
Exact same art. I mean, some of the code was still there, and they had to settle.
And Mafia Wars, even today, still has 3 to 4 million daily active users, not monthly.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this idea and the meme of it, you know, if you follow the lines of the poker game and War Book and Street Racer and some of these other games that came out, and then at Playdom they did Mobsters on MySpace, because MySpace also opened up, you know, and they succeeded really well doing the same types of games there. This all happened within, you know, this is the idea of the third wave that John Doerr talks about. Within 24 months, we basically created a multi-billion dollar gaming mm-hmm. industry out of nowhere. I mean, I remember when we went to the first Casual Game Summit, people were laughing at us, you know, 2 years ago. They, I mean, we were in a room, and, you know, none of the casual gaming people took us seriously. They thought it was a joke. And now they're all working for these companies.
Well, and the funny thing is the platform has changed so much, and all these larger players, frankly, are trying to get into the space. And it's such a unique skill set to figure out how to be successful on these platforms. And they still don't have necessarily the DNA to do what it takes to be successful, despite their size, despite the awesome IP that a lot of gaming and entertainment companies have that would probably port well to mobile and Facebook platforms.
And that's, I mean, if you look at it, it basically, I call it, in any space, you know, my philosophy is that there's about 100 people that are tremendously, you know, kind of amazing people that know the space really well. In social gaming, that's about right. There's about 100 people that know exactly what needs to be done to create these types of games that are successful.
Tim, and you and I were talking earlier this week about where Facebook fits into mobile apps, that platforms like Android and the Apple Store don't do social very well, actually. Can
right.
you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So everything that Lisa and Sherman are talking about is absolutely true, and it keys off the fact that Facebook had a thing called virality back in the day, right? Social means viral, meaning you can mm-hmm. invite friends and everything. That's how these games spread like wildfire. They go very quickly. You get invited by your grandma even. Next thing you know, you're playing Farmville. iPhone and smartphones never had virality, and I'll argue it's because Apple and Google, they never got social. They never really understood it, never really used it. So iPhone game developers and app developers never had the benefit of virality to go off of. Mm-hmm. That's why it was all about jockeying for chart position. So when you hear us talk about chart position, it's all about who can get in the top 25 and be
yep.
seen. It's tricky, though. You can't buy that slot from Apple. You can't, you know, lobby to get in there. Now you can buy it from other companies who will promote your app in their apps, but there's still no direct advertising way to do it from Apple proper, right? And MobClix is doing a lot in that area in terms of cross-promotion. But so app developers on iPhone had to synthesize virality through methods like incentivized installs, cross-promoted applications within a network, and all the things that, you know, MobClix released a lot of reports on. But that same thing is now going back onto Facebook, because why? Facebook has reduced the viral mechanisms,
right.
so all that viral stuff's gone away. So these Facebook developers who were great at viral engineering now are going, oh, my God, what do we do? Our daily active users are dropping, what was it, Lisa, 15% across the board or something like that?
In May alone.
Yeah, exactly. So they're facing what the iPhone guys faced from the start. Meanwhile, iPhone and Android are adding viral elements into their platform.
Right.
So you see this kind of like crisscross happening. So it's
yeah,
really,
in fact, I was at the launch for iPhone 4.0, and Steve Jobs presenting, and And you know, they launched Game Center, and they said Game Center, a social gaming network. And that's the name
well,
of
before,
my company.
Before
that was
we go
the
to
name
that.
Of my company.
before we go to that, I just wanted to to ask Krishna, you know, how these changes have how you've witnessed these changes as an addict.
So I think that, you know, the big thing about virality is it's really creating a lot of engagement, and brands want to be in that high engagement level. They, you know, and I think developers are realizing outside of the offer wall model, right? How do I make my applications free and still make money off of it? Because not all games are suited for, you know, virtual currency. And when you look at the majority of the app store, those apps are monetizing off of display ads, mm-hmm. right? And so virtual currency is great. It's got a certain type of user, certain type of gamer that's willing to pull out their credit card and, you know, spend additional money. But things add up. You know, you spend $10 a week and you add another $50 to your monthly cell phone bill, and it tacks on a toll, right? And I think Apple's done a great job of allowing you to, you know, the one-touch sort of download and revenue generation that they can do with that. But what we're starting to see is developers realize that engagement around these creatives and advertising becomes really important for brands, and things like rich media and video are becoming really valuable, and that's what we're starting to see. That's where people want to spend money on when they're advertising on the iPad and on the iPhone. They don't want just standard display ads. And, you know, that was one of the big things with the iAd announcement. It was nothing new. You know, that the same sort of rich media ads that Steve Jobs demonstrated during that keynote has been going around for, you know, over a year now. All the ad networks are doing that. But the big thing he did was bring awareness to it, which has really started to get a lot of the other ad networks, so guys like Millennial and JumpTap, to start getting these $1 million, you know, ad buys, ad RFPs from agencies saying, how do we spend $1 million? How do we do these types of rich media creatives? You know, how can we get that same engagement level that iAds and other types of format has?
And that makes it more profitable for...
Exactly. So, I mean, the more money brands spend, the higher engagement rates, you know, users have, the more money developers make. Mm-hmm.
Shervin, you started talking about Game Center. Yeah. Steve Jobs announced that they were starting this social network, a gaming network called Game Center, a couple months ago, and they haven't shared very many details, but we think there are going to be leaderboards, community discussion forums, achievements, right? How is that going to change things?
It's great. I mean, that's exactly Tim's point, is that iPhone itself wasn't a very social platform, and while Facebook has been removing all of the major kind of social notification channels and viral channels that people are using to grow so fast, iPhone is actually adding it. So you can actually send notifications for free within the iPhone platform, and Game Center is essentially the beginnings of the social glue that's needed between people that are on the iPhone together to begin connecting and sharing and playing and so on. At the same time, I think it's the first iteration or kind of the signal noise that, well, you know, something more is coming. Like, games obviously make sense for it to be first, but the social connections between all the apps and iPhone users is something that, you know, you could think about, well, you know, potentially Facebook integration deeply at the OS level would mean quite a lot. And so, you know, if you have that universal ID and you're able to combine that with iTunes, a lot of really interesting things are going to happen. So one of the things I've been saying is, you know, iPhone gaming and kind of app world is where Facebook gaming and app world was, you know, about, you know, 18 months ago. Well, so it's about to go through this huge spike.
Well, so I agree there's tons of growth there, but I do want to note that in a Facebook environment in particular, Facebook, one of the things that as they changed the way virals were working and cut things back substantially, one of the gives was building this gaming channel and this leaderboard of top games, and it was meant to be a mechanism to help the small guy actually get attention if you had a strong game and sort of keep the playing field more level. What has happened, however, is the adoption there probably hasn't been as strong as everyone had hoped it would be. And so while I think Apple doing this is great, I am a little bit I'll probably be a little bit more conservative and adopt more of a wait and see attitude about what it does, given what we've seen from Facebook. But in addition, you know, iPhone only has X percent of the market, so there's a lot of users, but it's definitely not as ubiquitous in terms as Facebook is, for example. And so I don't know how prevalent that's going to be and how much it's going to move the needle.
So let me just address that. So I agree with you. So it's, to me, it's an iPhone and Android world.
Yes.
That's where we're going. And so I think, you know, if you look at the number of units Android is shipping, I think it's over 100,000 a day now. Mm-hmm. And so it's essentially, you know, on par with iPhone. And what that means is that, you know, within a few years, we're going to be in a world where there's hundreds of millions of Android devices and mm-hmm. iPhone devices and potentially a billion users. And at that scale, the companies that are building those brands and those networks of players and connections and users are going to be poised to do tremendous amount of revenues. Because even at this scale and profits, even at this scale, it's pretty interesting. The model's working. Mm-hmm. And it just needs that fuel. But, you know, for me, the reason that I, you know, we went from Facebook to mobile is I've done mobile games for about 10 years. And I just knew that, you know, in the future, you know, everything we do will be mobile. It's not, I mean, we're not going to be using our computers the way we were using it before. Everything
Krishna,
needs to be
in terms of, sorry to interrupt.
Okay, that's okay.
Just as a point of reference, between Google's Android store and the Apple iPhones, can you share with us a little bit about the number of apps, how developers are looking at both stores and where they're putting their investments?
Yeah, so I'd say across the App Store, they're on the iPhone side, they're close to 200,000. You know, generally speaking, about 75% of them are paid and 25% are free. The top two categories are games and books. Looks like it's been switching, you know, back and forth over the last couple months, and then, you know, sort of tapers down from there. So it definitely means games and books are the type of apps that are being downloaded and consumed more frequently as well. On the Android side, what's pretty interesting is there's a lot more free applications than paid apps. And it's the one platform that has definitely been more open on that side, where developers are looking to just put their app out there for free. You know, we're definitely seeing on the advertising side for Android, we're seeing the growth rate month over month is much higher than the growth rate on iPhone. And I think one of the platforms we haven't really brought up, which could be kind of the X factor, is Windows Phone 7. And, you know, the types of devices that they're releasing for it with, you know, HTC, the HD2. I think, you know, Sprint sort of, you know, well, Google sort of stole that thunder a couple weeks ago at Google I.O. But, I mean, from an advertiser standpoint, we're definitely seeing interest already being generated for that. You know, it'd sort of be interesting to see where you see that from a gaming side.
When you say the advertisers are interested, how do you know?
We just see a lot of demand from brand advertisers coming in through ad networks saying, how do we get on this device? How do we get on Windows Phone 7 even before the devices have launched? I mean, it's not scheduled to be out until the fall.
I think one of the key things on the Facebook side, and I'll apply it to your question, is that the offer worlds, when the offers came in, it opened up the social games to the mass audience, for the people mm-hmm. that... Typically, we have users that, you know, have spent $30,000 buying virtual pets and foods, just one user.
One user.
Right? And so we both have that. So it's kind of like, okay, well, that's not the norm. Right? We would love that, but you know, it's not the norm. So it's so in that case, what happened with the offers allowed people to fill out offers in order to get those microtransactions. That really hasn't fully taken off on mobile. I think when and it will this year. By the end of this year, and when it does, I think it'll open up, you know, more people to kind of taste what it's like to do the microtransactions and go to a mass audience. The third area that I think is interesting is the glue between Android and iPhone users is really fascinating to me. So, like, you know, at Google.io, we launched Skies of Glory on Android and on iPhone. And we had the players shooting each other's planes down 10 at a time over 3G, but they were Android users versus iPhone users.
Yeah,
and so, you know, Apple and Google aren't going to like those connections, but we want that to happen. And there's an opportunity there to create a network to mm-hmm. connect those players together, because Game Center won't do it.
Yeah. That's actually a very critical path. One of the things that has prevented the big social gaming companies on Facebook from heavying up into mobile, so think Zynga and Rockyou and Playdom, is the fragmented nature of the market and the fact that the foundation of these games from an engagement perspective are twofold. One is social, right, so competing and engaging with your friends. The other one is this notion of the farming mechanic. But in the case of the social element, you know, it's only X percentage of our user base, call it 10%, actually have an iPhone. And we don't necessarily know what their friends also have. So it may be an iPhone, but it may be an Android, it may be something else. And so we've been reticent as organizations, given how large our games are on Facebook, to necessarily port a lot of that stuff over because it just, the size, the scale isn't there yet. But once we get these connections in place, it becomes a lot more interesting.
And Sherman, you and I spoke about this a while ago, but there is this reality that everybody has an app store. Everybody wants an app store that doesn't have one. Right. You've got Apple, the dominant app store. You've got Google that's up and coming and will probably surpass iPhones at some point in terms of devices. You've got Blackberries, which is still, there are a lot of them out there. And then you've got Windows Phone 7, which everybody's excited about, particularly in terms of what you could do with the Xbox as well. And then also you've got different kinds of devices on the same operating system, right? Android's got the television, Apple's got the iPad. I mean, how do you bring all that together? And
yeah, I mean, I think the users will simplify that equation. They're choosing the things that are the most innovative and interesting and simple to use and that other people are using. And so, I mean, I think a world, you know, as you've said this, you know, the Nokia OV storage should just be renamed Over. I mean, it's just there's nothing there. The BlackBerry App Store is horrible. I mean, there's nothing there. And, you know, we were being asked to develop a bunch of stuff, but as a startup, we just don't have the cycles and the resources. It's not smart to go to a platform and spend a bunch of time building it until you know that it's actually for real. So for us, it's really, again, back to it's iPhone and Android. And I think ultimately, you know, it will be that. It's basically PC and Apple, you know, back in...
And I just want to interject here and say that we're going to be taking questions soon. So if anybody has questions, please start lining up at the mic right there.
So I'm going to bring up one wrinkle, though. Let's fast forward the discussion 3 years from now. I will posit that the app is dead, and then it'll be long live the app. And here's what I mean. Today, a consumer doesn't know if an app is a piece of content, a bookmark to a browser page, or some other dedicated piece of code. And we have an artificial landscape here in the U.S. because Apple and Google want their app stores to win. They constrain the devices from supporting things like Flash natively to run applications and other things which should have mirrored the Japan market. Look at Japan. Flash Lite was supported in most phones by the carrier. As a result, they've had online social game companies making money for months now.
Yep.
Never built an app. These things ran in the browser.
Yep.
So HTML5 is the big stinky fish in the room that people are not sure how to address. Because if HTML5 really takes off and is universally accepted, the App Store's strength fades a lot. Why build an app? Why not just launch it as HTML5?
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think, you know, we've been looking at HTML5 as well, and it's one way of going around the App Store. But ultimately, the function, feature functionality-wise, it should be the same.
Yeah.
So whether you distribute your app as a HTML5 app or you know, through the Apple App Store, it doesn't really ultimately matter to us, except for, you know, how do we use our resources and so on. But, I mean, I think the opportunity to have an HTML5 App Store in general, you know, aggregate all of that is pretty interesting.
Exactly.
So, Lisa, how do you plan your strategy with this future mind?
How do we plan our strategy around?
Around this possibility.
So, we definitely, given our size at this point, we have the luxury, a little bit of sort of wait and see. And I definitely agree with Shervin in we wait to see which platforms are doing well and making it before we go and invest heavily in programs. I mean, you can look at Zynga, for example. A lot of the things they've done to get off of Facebook that they've announced in the last 6 months have been what I would call reasonably safe bets, right? It's largely been online. It's been Yahoo Games. It's been MSN Games. It's been sort of extensions. It's been Farmville.com. It's been extensions of their traditional online experience. And I think a lot of us are definitely in a little bit of a wait-and-see mode to see which platforms are really emerging, with iPhone and Android sort of the no-brainers, but everything else still very much up in the air.
As a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inform program, and tonight we're hosting Mobile Apps, Shifting Dynamics of a Digital World. I'm Yukari Watani-Kane, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and I'm here with Krishna Subramanian, co-founder of MobClix, Tim Chang, principal of Norwest Venture Partners, Shervin Pishvar, founder and executive chairman of the Social Gaming Network, and Lisa Marino, chief revenue officer of RockU. We'd like to go into questions.
Hi there. So my question is about monetization. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about, in this conversation, a lot about monetization. It's basically fallen into two categories, one bigger than the other. One is kind of the virtual currency purchase, either directly with cash or with offers, and the other one is advertising.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, do you feel that those will work for non-game apps going forward? And if not, what are the alternatives that can work? I mean, it's hard for me to see if the mobile platform is really going to be a mass replacement for laptops, et cetera. You have lots of utilities, functions, sort of day-to-day things that you may not want to be interrupted with advertising, and certainly the enhancement model that seems so natural for games, I'm not clear that it works there. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
So, well, it depends on the type of app, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think anything that's content-driven, so it doesn't have to be games, it mm-hmm. could be news, it
yep.
could be Yahoo, it could be anything where I'm consuming information. I think advertising works extremely well there because brands definitely want to be adjacent to a mommy blog when it's Procter & Gamble, for example. When you're dealing with more utilitarian apps, I mean, there's definitely still going to be a situation where you pay to download the app, right? If advertising and virtual currency monetization don't necessarily work for your experience, you've still got pay to play. And yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so outside of virtual currency on games, when advertisers and brands come to us, one of the biggest questions they ask for, what apps do you have that are not games or that are not in the social networking space, right? For whatever reason, they don't want to be on like the MySpace type of applications, whether it's on the web or on the mobile space. So they'll want to be associated to finance apps or sports apps or travel apps, mm-hmm. and those types of content driven things definitely add a lot of value, and that's what they want their brand to be associated with. And so there's definitely ways to make money using.
So you feel that those types of apps can generate an ad premium over games?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure.
So the biggest, and I'll be very honest because I deal with this every single day, the biggest hurdle in getting brand advertisers to participate in social gaming is this natural affinity to want to be next to relevant content. So Herbal Essences, for example, wants to be next to health and beauty. Well, Farmville and Zoo World don't really have that, right? So if you as an app can bring some relevant content to the table, there are many, many monetization opportunities from an advertising perspective that will pay you premium, like top CPM, far better than you're going to get in a gaming environment because of the content adjacencies for that brand.
Yep, I would agree. And I'll give you my perspective on what I've seen from a lot of our portfolio companies. I see a playbook with four patterns. Number one, if it's a vertical app with very esoteric type of usage, like let's say it's the bar exam app or something like that, you could probably charge $100 or $1,000 or something.
Okay.
The second would be, to Lisa's point, free with advertising, and the more targeted it is, the better you can get premium CPMs.
Mm-hmm.
Third one we talked about, virtual goods or some sort of microtransaction. Doesn't have to be a game, but it could be a pay-to-play or pay-per-view type of microtransaction. And the fourth, someday I think we'll have upsell into subscription-based applications, right? So if you think about a lot of these apps, the GQ app could be the future of GQ magazine,
mm-hmm.
right? So those will be four ways you could play it.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Two questions. We haven't heard much about Palm's WebOS, and I'm interested in your thoughts about HP's acquisition and where the future of Palm may be in sort of the world of apps. And then secondarily, one of the things that buzzes through the network now about Android is the fragmentation of their operating system. And so is that really an issue or not? If you guys could address that, that'd be great.
Let's take Palm first, because that's a pretty easy one from my perspective. There's so much that needs to be fleshed out there that that's definitely a wait and see what happens there. There is not a clear value proposition for app developers today from a scale perspective, and it's just very, very risky. So, you know, it's going to be challenging to get developers, I think, to really go gung-ho on that platform until HP comes out with a really clear strategy and execution for what's next for that platform.
Just out of curiosity, about a year ago when we were all writing furiously about the Palm Pre, I mean, did you guys think about...
So I've been a victim of the Pre for about a year. My husband bought it, I think, a day or two after it came out. And it crapped out at this point, so it doesn't even work anymore.
Tim?
So, you know, interesting observation. The people who run the PSG, Personal Systems Group, within HP are all former Palm executives. So, in essence, Palm was bought by HP by people who used to work there. But here's the biggest question. Will the Personal Systems Group take over the Palm asset and run it like a consumer smartphone, in which case I say too little too late, sorry.
Yeah.
Or, even better, should the business group take it, take WebOS, which is actually really well-suited for enterprise tablets? Because the biggest request I hear is from enterprises saying, I love the iPad, but it ain't rugged enough for field usage. If I drop the thing, it's toast. So the market opportunity exists for HP to take Palm and turn them into ruggedized enterprise and business tablets. That's what I think they should do.
That's a great idea.
Krishna, do you want to take the fragmentation question at the Android?
Yeah. What was the question again?
The question was whether that fragmentation on the Android, the fact that it's across different mobile phones by different manufacturers, it's different form factors, different screen sizes, and whether that's an issue.
Yeah, no, so I definitely think that's a big issue, right? Because from a developer standpoint, if I have to create a different app for with a different screen size, running a different chipset, and you know, certain devices have different functionality, it becomes a big pain in the butt for me, right? And I think that's one of the reasons when, you know, going to Windows Phone 7, they've gone ahead and said, okay, here's the screen resolution, and here's what the minimum requirements are on the chipset, and every device that gets built has to have these minimum requirements to sort of help out developers on that end.
Though it makes me wonder, though, too, because the appeal of Android, if you really think about Android, it's what Linux Mobile was supposed to be. Do you remember when Linux Mobile was this big topic and everybody said, oh, we're going to do Linux? Well, it never got the support because it was, you know, kind of a open standard done by coalition that never works. But Android was put out there, and Google doesn't care if you customize it. In fact, you can even rip out the search and replace it with Bing if you want. And so it's made to be fragmented, and that's why carriers and handset makers love it. But it creates a lot of problem because everyone wants their own flavored version of Android. And so this is going to cause a lot of problems because what if certain apps only run on certain flavors of Android? Then it's no longer interoperable. So it is kind of that whole Linux mess all over again. But it'll be fun to watch.
Lisa, do you want to share your thinking on how you see the Android apps? And
well, so having a lot of experience building for multiple platforms, I can tell you that we just pick the one that's got the most scale. So when you're dealing in a fragmented environment, that, you know, that's a huge, huge ding against whether or not that's an opportunity for us, right? And one of the things I think Apple's gotten pretty correct is, you know, they're doing a pretty decent job of giving you the opportunity to build, not perfectly, but in a scalable way for iPhone and for iPad and a couple of other executions. And you don't have as many issues in that environment as you do with Android. And fundamentally, all this comes down to scale and being able to leverage a single code base to reach millions of users on a daily basis.
So what do you need to see to go into Android more fully?
Definitely a way for them to create a least common denominator. And I suspect they know that, right? And they're, you know, and that least common denominator needs to come with some pretty rich functionality that can incorporate, you know, a user experience like what we're used to seeing in some iPhone experiences.
And probably one of the most critical to that point is probably the one click to purchase. Yep. If you were to ask me, the only reason Apple iPhone really took off, yeah, great hardware and all that, it's because they had 100 million credit cards in iTunes already. So you already trained by Apple to click the button and purchase. That's the part no one could crack before. And that's the part, honestly, Android's missing. Mm-hmm. They have Google Checkout, but come on, let's be honest. How many people really use Google Checkout here, right? So you know how you're bringing up the stat of all the apps on Android are free? I think it's because a lot of people just can't command the, you know, the billing. There's no way to buy them easily.
Well, and if I were Android on that note, work with PayPal.
Yeah.
I mean, we've, you know, there's a lot of social games out there that have one-click buy.
Yeah.
And that is a fundamental piece of an engine that gets monetization from 1% usage to 3% usage. Primarily because you're going to see on a daily basis at least half of your users are repeat purchasers, with 50% of your users being new, and having an easy way for those repeat purchasers to buy, especially when you're making them limited time offers and things like that in a game, absolutely jacks up your monetization.
Yep.
Can we have the next question?
Yeah, I noticed from researching the new HDTVs that they have become basically a platform in some sense. The mm-hmm. download widgets, I can get, you know, Hulu widgets and Skype widgets and YouTube widgets and whatnot. And they even have basically the analog to an app store for these widgets. I can update and get new ones and shop next month and see what they've got. I kind of wonder how much does tomorrow's TV look a lot like and mirror a lot of the comments that you've made today about mobile platform.
I think tomorrow's TV, I don't know that it's necessarily a platform. I think it just begins to replace your computer screen, right? And you use it in a similar function. Believe me, I'd way rather be watching my big screen TV playing a game than necessarily doing it on my iPhone, right? And if I can, you know, if I can go to iTunes or go to the App Store, buy my app, and it knows that it's me because I've signed in with my iTunes account, and I can play it on my TV and I can play it on my phone. Well, that's the best of both worlds, right? Because I play it on my phone when I'm sitting in the airport going to New York, and I play it with my kids at home. You know, I can play Tap Tap Revenge to Kesha or, you know, B.O.B. or whoever the cool guy is for them at the moment, in a very cool and engaged environment. So I see it sort of morphing into that.
Yeah, I would agree. And you know, one trend I noticed at the Consumer Electronics Show, every device started having an internet connection. As soon as everything has an internet connection, is connected to the cloud, it is ready to have an app store. Mm-hmm. So let's assume every device you own someday will have an internet connection and have some form of an app type of store. Your wristwatch, your refrigerator, that comment, your car, and the apps would be a way to get all the stuff you already like to do, Pandora, CBS, MarketWatch, whatever, as well as maybe personalization settings. So maybe you download an app to your Prius someday and it's got the turbocharge mode or something like that, and then the next day you download the commuter profile for maximizing gas mileage or whatever it is. But that's the benefit when things are connected to the internet. Suddenly it opens up this availability of app stores. Yeah.
And I think once you start connecting to the cloud and the internet, and you know, once you start downloading stuff on one device, I think you're going to start to see things where you're able to access that same content on multiple devices without having to re-download it again. Mm-hmm. So downloading the Netflix application or downloading music from iTunes, right, when you download it on your iPhone, it's a pain now to go ahead and sync it back to your iPad. And I think at, you know, the Google I/O conference, that's one of the things they mentioned is being able to, you know, go down that direction, you know, or sort of hinted at, is being able to download your music and have access to it from any device that you own.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other questions?
I'll throw another one. So at Tim, early on you said that in the old days when you were talking about 3G, you meant something a little different. And right now, in today's environment, the U.S., two of those 3Gs are deeply throttled, right? Gambling is restricted because U.S. law doesn't allow credit card transactions used for online gambling. And as the dominant smartphone in the United States today, or the one we basically get excited about and talk about, is the iPhone. And Steve Jobs has drawn a very, very clear line that he does not want pornography on the iPhone, at least through the App Store.
Right.
How do you see both of those Gs evolving over the next few years?
Remember how we brought up HTML5?
Yeah.
HTML5 starts to hybridize the world of the browser and the world of the App Store. Pretty soon you won't be able to tell what's an app versus in the browser. And when you're really in the browser, you can go anywhere you want. So that's when you can do anything on the open web, I think.
What about the gambling side of it?
Well, we've got regulation issues in the U.S. I wonder if the need for our revenue to fuel our deficit will make that legal again soon, amongst other things. I think it might be deregulated at some point because it's a great tax revenue generator.
That's why we're talking about taxing pot sales in California.
Totally, right? And at that point, man, talk about addiction. This mobile device always in your pocket is a perfect place to gamble all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And if it's taxable for revenue for the U.S. government, great. But I think that it will happen. And in the meanwhile, social games, one of the first kinds of social games was social poker.
Yeah.
The only difference between gambling and these sort of casino games is money can come in, but money can't come out.
Correct.
What's your game, Tim?
Hmm?
What's your game?
I stink at gambling. Oh, venture capital is gambling.
We have spent a lot of time talking about games, and I'm just wondering about, you know, what are the other categories? What's the up-and-coming category this year?
So this year for me is the year of shopping. And I've been looking at this for several months now. When you think of things like Facebook credits, Facebook has made it very, very clear. They haven't necessarily said this outright, but in some of the things that they're doing on the gaming side, you can see what they're trying to create in this environment. Facebook wants you to be able to shop on Facebook with Facebook credits, right? So you can buy shoes or a purse or sign up for Groupon and buy a deal through them using FB credits. And in that environment, things become very interesting and very, very powerful because now you've got a really interesting social element and the consummate recommendation engine in a social environment. So I look at mobile applications and Facebook, really, this is the year of shopping.
Krishna?
I'd definitely say entertainment and consuming, you know, different types of content. So you start looking at magazines and movies and look at what the iPad is doing to that, right? In terms of the way people are recreating their magazines specifically for the iPad. I think when you look at Time Magazine and the Financial Times, and there's all these little widgets that they're building into the same online content, the printed out content that you'd pick up at the stores, and they're basically taking this disposable content and making it, you know, indisposable and giving you access to it anytime you want. So I think not just from a periodical standpoint, but also from an element of being able to get access to any type of movie or movies or anything like that are going to become more and more dominant.
I think the remainder of this year, social location and check-in is really hot.
Oh, yes.
So for those of you using Foursquare and Booyah and Gowalla, that's super hot. But where I want it to go next, what I want to do next year is actually health, wellness, nutrition, fitness, those areas. I want to use these game mechanics we've been talking about today and maybe change consumer behavior in that type of way.
Great. We'll take one last question.
Yeah, just a kind of a follow-up. So what do you think of the state of HTML5? How soon before that's actually a viable development?
I think it's 2 years off still for running full-blown high-performance apps like games. The reason why, the way it is today, download all the game assets to the client and render it in the client side first, it's not practical, so we still have a ways to go.
I think we've got a little bit more time, so I'll ask one last question. What's your favorite app?
My favorite app?
Yeah. What's the app that people don't know about but you think is great?
My favorite app actually is one that's not out yet. We're working on it. But it's something that I'm very, very excited about, so I can't actually talk about it. Especially with the VC of a competitor at the table. However, one that I play today, there's a new game out called Nightclub City by Booyah, which is really good and fun. And then there's Baking Life. That's another new game that came out a few weeks ago. That's doing quite well. And in a mobile environment, my whole family's addicted to revenge. And I think Tabulous has gotten me for about $40, and wow. My kids buy every single new song that comes out.
That's awesome.
Tim?
So I have to put props up for my portfolio companies. Brain Trainer by Lumos Labs is really good. It's the first real neuroscience-based healthy brain training app, and it's actually quite good. Check it out on the iPhone as well as on the web. All the games by NG Moco, like We Rule, are really addictive.
Yeah, We Rule's good.
Yeah, mobile social games. But then I guess I'd add on top of that the, well, I just bought a Sonos, and you can use the Sonos app to control the thing on your iPhone. That's really cool. So I've enjoyed that. And then lastly, I would say Lose It is a really cool app if you haven't seen that one. It's how people check in what they eat and stuff like that, and good dieting program.
Krishna?
Yeah, I'd say when I first got my iPhone, the favorite game I loved demoing was Crash Bandicoot. And at that time, it was one of the first sort of car racing games where you can actually enable the accelerometer and sort of turn it around. And it was an amazing way to sort of demo what the iPhone's capabilities were. You know, today, I'd say probably one of the frequently used apps on there is, you know, Shazam, just a simple app. And I think one of the reasons it's starting to get me is not only do you start, you know, figuring out what songs you're listening to, but it's really easy to, just with two clicks, you can download that song off of iTunes. So it gets pretty addicting.
Great. Finally, it's a new tradition of 2010 that we're asking all speakers the following question, and I think Tim's been nominated in the back room because he was the last to arrive. So you've got 60 seconds to change the world.
All right, here's the recipe to change the world. We've been talking about mobile, so now everybody's going to have smartphones, which are cloud-connected and capable of getting apps. Add to that the fact that the mobile device is full of sensors. You got GPS on it. You got accelerometers. What if we were to start adding other things on it, too, like heart rate monitors or other types of things where you can get health signals? What we're really talking about is personal data collection. So the way we save the world is as people get more mobile devices, you're collecting more data about people. If you give that data back to people and wrap it with a set of game mechanics and social media rules, and then make those games apply to things like what you eat, what you do, how you exercise, I think we will fix this consumer health mess. That's my personal opinion, but it's through data, mobile devices, applications, and then these game mechanics to start changing people's behavior in for the positive.
Tim, if you can get me off McDonald's, you've done one hell of a job.
There's an app for that.
There's an app for that.
So if anyone has an idea, you know who to go to sell it.
Yes.
Well, let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. And this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.